Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And you're about to get to know the entrepreneur behind Tetris, the guy responsible for spreading Tetris around the world and on just about every device with a screen on it. His name is Hank Rogers, and this guy's got an attitude of the can-do attitude that entrepreneurs need in order to leave their mark on the world, in order to do something with their lives. And I think I could sum it up in a quote that I wrote down as he was talking. He said, "We have to make this work somehow." That's the attitude that he walked into a situation where, well, he created his first game, he took it out into the world and nobody was interested, and he burned through his money and nobody was interested. But he said, "I had to find a way to make it work." And he did. Listen to how he did. Listen to how he turned that situation around. It's also the same attitude that he walked into a meeting with Nintendo with. Nintendo talked to him, didn't want to have anything to do with him, or didn't want to partner with him, but he said he had to find a way to build a partnership with them, and he did, and listen to how he did that. Also, Nintendo was actually invented by a developer in the Soviet Union. There was a big mess around it because the Soviets weren't into commerce, as you know. He needed to find a way to bring Tetris out of the Soviet Union in order to put it out on all these consoles. Listen to how he did it. That same "we have to find a way to make it work somehow" attitude that he brought to just about anything in his life. If you are ever in a jam, if you're ever struggling with something, you got to think back on this interview, because you're going to see a guy who's struggled and had all kinds of issues in his life, and he kept finding a way to make it work somehow. Very inspirational. And I think just his energy alone is going to get you going. All right, two things before we get started with the actual program. The first is, we did this interview from Hawaii, from actually two different locations on two different days. I shouldn't say we, I was here in my office in Santa Monica, but he was in Hawaii, where the internet connection kept dropping off. So we had to piece this interview back together. As I say, it's over 2 days of piecing back together a conversation that kept breaking off. Hopefully it's all okay. If there are any issues, please tell me. If there aren't any issues, then it means that Paola, my editor, does not belong editing for Mixergy. She should be in Hollywood editing real movies, because to piece all this together has got to be a work of art and talent beyond any single video here that I can produce on Mixergy. So please thank Paola if we are able to make it work, and if we aren't, if there are issues, let us know and we'll fix them. The second thing is, I don't know if you know this, but I do a lot of my interviews live with a live audience. And often we have an interesting conversation while we're getting set up. Hank, while we were getting set up, showed us all his place in Hawaii. I want to spend a few seconds here. I think it's about half a minute showing you his place in Hawaii. I think it's beautiful. I think it's inspiring. I think it sets the scene. And then I'll come back afterwards to get you started with the program itself. So here's a quick video of him showing you and me and everyone who is watching us live his place in Hawaii.
And so... I don't even know if you can see it. Can you see it?
Oh, yeah, I can see it.
That's the pu'u. That is pu'u va'ava'a.
That's the valley.
That's the valley. And so that's the main house. And we are 28 acres inside of 120,000-acre conservation land.
Wow, And so you bought it to make sure that it's conserved, right?
I bought it so I could have some peace and quiet. That's what I do. I preserve it. I mean, that is the idea. Let's find a good spot out here. Yeah, this is pretty cool. I've never done this before.
Yeah, this is incredible. No one's ever taken me for a walk around their place before. All right, let's leave it there. Beautiful place. I just want to set the scene for you, let you know where he was. Soon after that, sat down and we did the interview that you're about to watch, my interview for you with Hank Rogers, the entrepreneur behind Tetris. All right, hang on. Before we get into the actual program, I've got a big announcement to make. And to help me with that announcement, I invited my fiance Olivia here. Olivia?
Yes, we have our first sponsor, which is FreshBooks.
FreshBooks, first sponsor on Mixergy. All right, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to show you how easy it is to create an account on FreshBooks, how fast it is, and you're going to be able to use this account to create your invoices, to organize your billing, and so much more. Olivia, can you time me as we do this?
I've got it.
All right, here we go. I'm going to click try it free.
And
All right, let's do it. I'm going to type in my real company name. There's Mixergy. I'm going to type in my real email address, mail@awarner.com, as most of you know, and I'm going to hit create account.
Okay, that was like seven seconds.
7 seconds to create an account. The account is technically created, but let's keep going, Olivia. Keep timing me because I'm going to log into my new account. Yes, I'm going to tell Apple to save my username and password.
Yeah, no, and while you're doing this, Andrew, let's tell them that if, you know, they want to find out how much you're making from this ad this month, they should sign up for FreshBooks and send you an invoice using it, and you'll reveal the number.
So if they go in, create an invoice, and invoice me, I will, yeah, good idea. I will absolutely, if you invoice me using FreshBooks, right. I will tell you how much money I've made from it.
39 seconds.
39 seconds. Very important. Before we continue, they have to know to type in my name or my company name and how did you hear about us. Type in Mixergy so I get some credit here for doing this kind of marketing for them. This is pretty good. Don't you think, Olivia? I'm a pretty good pitchman. All right. Get started. Boom. Timey. How much? 49 seconds to create an account. If you go to FreshBooks and spend 49 seconds, create an account, and invoice me, you will discover two things. How much money I'm making from FreshBooks, and number two, you're going to see how easy it is to create invoices and how easy it is to do billing online using FreshBooks and so much more. But that's the heart of it right there. All right. Congratulations to Mixergy. Congratulations to me. Congratulations to you.
Let's go to the program.
Let's go to the program. Well, first of all, before we go before Tetris, let me ask you this. What are you most proud of with your success with Tetris?
With Tetris?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a game designer, I'm it's kind of a silly thing, but I did some of the inventions that are around Tetris in terms of how the game changed. For example, I invented single, double, triple Tetris. In other words, if you go back in time, before I got it, the game was just about surviving. And I invented the concept of earning more points by simultaneously clearing lines. So it's not about the money. It's about the game design, I guess.
I see.
So, yeah, and the T-spin, the rotation. There's a bunch of things I've added to Tetris as a game designer, which is sort of what I do in the background. That I'm proud of because I created something.
Do you still work on Tetris?
Oh yeah.
Oh, you do.
We do. I mean, we. I specifically think of ways to turn Tetris into a virtual sport. So I'm very focused on trying to make Tetris into a spectator sport, which means that it should look interesting from the viewpoint of somebody watching the game. So the games can't get like one pattern. If all the top players in the world look exactly the same, that would be no good. You know, if you look at tennis, there's all these different personalities and there's different ways of playing, close to the net, far from the net, you know, attack style, defense style, all these different kind of things. And I want to be able to get those kind of things to come out in the game.
I hadn't thought of that it should be interesting to somebody watching Tetris in addition to being fun for the person playing it.
Yeah.
You know, so you're the guy who's responsible for that. I would come home and watch my dad or my brother play Tetris, and I would somehow get captivated by it. And I'd say, this is just blocks falling on a screen. Why am I sitting here? And it's because of you.
I have, you know, part of it. I don't know if somebody else got it, if they would have taken it down the same path. But the other thing, you know, on the business level, people kind of credit me for the longevity of Tetris. I mean, I got a hold of it in 1989 or 1988, and Alexei, the author of Tetris, kind of put it in my hands in 1993 and asked me to help him out. And I've been on that job ever since, and Tetris is still alive. In fact, Tetris is more alive today than it's ever been before, in that there are, you know, each year we sell more Tetris than the year before. Maybe this is a recession year. Maybe it will be flat this year compared to last year. But, for example, last year was the biggest year for Tetris in history.
Do you know how many copies have been sold overall throughout time?
Yeah, it's kind of a complicated calculation because, for example, on certain online or mobile situations, people subscribe to a service, and that service contains Tetris. And they're really going there for Tetris, and the other ones are just fluff. But, you know, whether we get a point for that or not, that's a question. But let's do the calculation, you know, based on history. We did around 70 million as a box product, and then we did another 70 million as downloads on mobile phones.
Wow. And it's available.
And the, you know, when we get to online, how do you calculate that? Because, you know, we do probably a couple hundred thousand daily uniques. And so that gets, I don't know how you calculate, how you even calculate that.
And it's available on calculators too and all kinds of other devices that you never would expect games on.
So I ordered and I have a giant spreadsheet with all screens in the world. You know, all I want to know is LCD screens, whatever the screens are, I want to know where in the world they are. And I want to know how many Tetrises, what is our penetration on that particular screen. So how many screens are we on? And he basically, I tell him, go and get us our expected penetration rate on that device.
So if you see that there are new flat screen TVs out there, you're sitting there thinking, how do we get Tetris on those devices?
Yes.
Wow. When I get my new iPhone, you're wondering, how can we get more penetration into Andrew's iPhone so that he can play even there?
Yeah, and it's very interesting. You know, you talk about an iPhone, and that's a very interesting one because we worked on the interface, the iPhone interface, and now a bunch of iPhone wannabe guys are out there, and they have touchscreens, but they don't work nearly as well as the iPhone touchscreen. So you click, but you can do. Okay, the whole iPhone interface doesn't work on the other devices, so I have to reinvent a device. It's goofy, but it's interesting. It keeps it interesting.
All right, so let's go back in time to before you were the guy behind Tetris to when you were living in Japan at the time. I understand. What were you doing in Japan?
I played Dungeons & Dragons in college. You wanted to know about Japan, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so we had an organization in college called ARG, ARRGH, which is the sound of, I guess, a monster or, anyway. ARG stands for the Alternative Recreational Realities Group of Hawaii.
Okay.
Okay. And what we did was we played board games, we played Dungeons and Dragons, that kind of stuff. And my major in university was computer science. So 6 years later, I'm in Japan. I've already chased a girl to Japan. We're married. I have three kids. And personal computers happen. So here I get access to a personal computer. I say, you know what? I could build a game for this thing, not knowing anything about anything. So fine. So... I got myself a personal computer and I start working. And I decided to make a role-playing game because that's what I like to do in college. And we are talking about cassette tape-based. It's 1983 now. And we're talking about a country where nobody knows what a role-playing game is. So those are two little, I would say, interesting problems. So I had to make an introductory role-playing game for people that have never played role-playing games before. And I had to fit it into something like 56K because the system took some space. Can you imagine? So, I mean, it must be some of your listeners must be from that age. There were a couple of games back then on the Apple IIe, and one was Ultima and one was Wizardry. And so Ultima was a sort of a top-down kind of game, a top scroll, and then Wizardry had a little fake 3D that you could walk through and, like, turn corners, and so it was a little 3D. Of course, I mean, we had no real compute power back then. So, but anyway, that game was the number one game in Japan in 1984. So I struck it rich, so to speak, and... I'd gone to SoftBank to ask them for advice on choosing a publisher. And SoftBank said to me back then, and back then SoftBank was 50 people doing their rack jobbers. What they do is they go to electric shops and they change the little boxes on shelves or add boxes to shelves. Now, of course, they're a huge, huge venture capital firm, whatever. But anyway, back then they were tiny, and they said, you know what, just do it yourself. You don't actually need a publisher, your wife will answer the phone, and all you got to do is you do the programming, and we'll send you the money. I said, oh, no, that sounds good. Of course, that was that was so far from the truth, it's ridiculous. But I don't think I would have started this business without not knowing what I was getting into. So
when you say you struck it rich, that you had a hit with that first game, you just wrote it yourself, and how did you make it into such a big success?
Well, first of all, what can I say? You know, I love programming, so I think looking back on it, I think I did an amazing job of fitting a huge object into a tiny little box. And keeping it interesting. And, you know, I had planned to do, you know, this big of a game, but I could only fit this much into that 56K. But I divided that 56K into little bits and pieces fairly effectively so that I didn't give any part of the game more attention than it deserved. And I listened to my test players as they played, you know, if whether it was too easy or too hard or, you know, interesting here or, you know, what's going on. And I adjusted the game. So we had an intense test play period before we released the product. And then Christmas came and SoftBank had promised they would buy 3,000 copies. And then they came and they ordered 600. So I said, oh, my God, we've completely failed. And I'd blown my minuscule advertising budget because the amount of money I had to start the whole company with was $50,000, which is kind of cute. And I'd blown some significant amount of that on my first ads, which were concept ads in magazines. But nobody knew what the hell a role-playing game was. So the first month we got one phone call, and then I said, oh, we got to put screenshots in this thing. So I put some screenshots in there, and then the next month we got 3 phone calls. So we were dead meat. Anyway, come January, I said, we got to make it, you know. And this is the entrepreneur coming through. Oh my gosh, yeah, that's okay. This is my entrepreneur coming through. I said, we got to make this work somehow. And so I decided to go to every computer game magazine in Japan at the time and show them how to play my game. And so I went to every magazine, created them characters, got them started on the game and so on, because, you know, I could understand that they didn't know what the hell this game was. And so why should they be interested in it? And if they didn't know how to play, you know, so on and so forth. Well, every magazine came out in March with rave reviews about the game, which is about the time I was running out of money. And so in May we had, in April we had like 10,000 orders. It just went crazy. And we were consistently the number one game after that.
So you just walked into their offices and you said, I've got this game. Can I teach it to you?
Yeah. Well, I didn't just walk in. You know, I make appointments. I didn't just walk in because you walk in and you don't know whether the guy that you want to talk to is going to be there or not.
And they were willing to listen because you had something novel.
You know, like it's really weird for, you know, a gaijin to want to come and talk to you about a game that he's, and that's already like, you know, a troll coming to visit your office or something. He's like, whoa, what the hell, you know? And in general, these people would have to go out to get stories, and here I'm bringing them a story. So they were nice to me.
All right, and around the same time, there was a kid in the Soviet Union named Alexei Pajitnov. How do you pronounce his name?
Alexei Pajitnov.
Pajitnov.
He was not a kid. He was my age.
Oh, he was. About how old were you guys at the time?
He still is my age. What's that? Sorry?
How old were you guys at the time?
Okay, so I was 29 when I wrote Black Onyx. So when he invented Tetris, which is 1984, which is when I had my big hit in Japan, I was 30 and he was 30. So we weren't kids.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. You know, you always assume that it's guys in their teens or early 20s who are building companies, single, working on their own, eating nothing but ramen. But as I do these interviews, I see over and over, it's all ages, it's all walks of life, it's all it's all over the place as far as married kids, not necessarily people living alone.
I had to have personal computers. I had to wait for the personal computers to appear before I could start my business. So that was a little bit of a handicap.
So he was working on this back in the old Soviet Union, and he just invented this. Can you tell people the circumstances that where he was building it and who owned it?
Yeah. You know, the Soviet Union is a kind of a crazy place at that point in time. It's the Soviet Union itself, the system there doesn't recognize intellectual property. So if you create something, basically it belongs to everybody. Okay, so where were we?
That's a good question. Where were we? We were talking about, let me go back into my notes here. We were talking about how at the time you and Alexei were 30 years old, and how you and what he was doing while you were building, while you were creating your software. What was the name of your program, by the way?
It was called the Black Onyx.
The Black Onyx. Okay.
Black Onyx.
Onyx.
Yeah, I used to be in the gem business, and the first 100 people I made at the end of the game, I sent them an actual Black Onyx.
Oh, wow. Well, there's marketing right there. So we're talking about how you went out and you sought reporters, and you sat down and you showed them how to play your game, and you created accounts for them, and now you're talking about how you sent a gem to the top players. And while you were doing all that, what was Alexei doing?
Alexei was working for the computer center of the USSR at the time, and that's so he was a programmer basically doing artificial intelligence for them, and he did Tetris in his sort of spare time. Of course, he used company computers, so to speak, or you know, because everything was owned by the company. There's no, you know, at this point in time, they didn't even have the word personal computer, because there's no personal property. So it's just the computer. And he was programming, and he was changing from one piece of hardware to another piece of hardware. And he needed to write a test program just to see if he understood the new language and all that. And what he was programming for was a machine called the Electronica 60, which is a copy of the PDP-11. In fact, you know, if you go back far enough, I actually worked on the PDP-11 myself in the 70s. So it's a real dinosaur machine. And it didn't have any graphics. I mean, it barely had a monitor. So the original version of Tetris was all text graphics. And the blocks were made out of little square brackets. You know, that you have, you know, the square brackets instead of the round brackets on your keyboard. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's two of those made a block. And so the whole thing was text. And there were little dots on the screen to mark where the grid was. It was really, really primitive.
And
so that's what he was doing in 1984.
And his game spread throughout Russia, as I understand it, right?
It spread throughout the entire, behind the Iron Curtain. It's a pretty interesting story about that, because it killed productivity everywhere. People were playing Tetris instead of working. Well, it's not like you're going to get fired if you're the country would have to pay you no matter what you did or what you didn't do. So they kind of, you know, depended on the goodness of your heart to get work done. But you get a serious distraction like Tetris going on, and it spread. And in those days, the way things spread was you would copy them onto a floppy disk. It was floppy disk. So it would again hand it from floppy disk to floppy disk to floppy disk. And so what happened is you would install Tetris. Now, the government decided that this was a threat to national security. And they created a program to kill Tetris. And the way that worked was sort of like you inoculated your, it's like virus protection. You inoculated your computer against Tetris, and if it found Tetris on your computer, it would erase Tetris, and then it would attempt to erase Tetris from any disk that is attached to that computer. So that was the whole idea. It was funny how they treated it like a, well, maybe it was, you know. There are a lot of people who played Tetris obsessively, and maybe they still do.
That's what I'm seeing.
More power to them.
So how did it go from being behind the Iron Curtain to getting in front of it, to getting out into the free world?
Well, okay, so originally, there's a guy named Robert Stein who has a software company in Hungary, in Budapest. In fact, it's right next door to Erno Rubik, his company, you know, the Rubik's Cube. And he is doing development work for other companies in Budapest. And all of a sudden, he notices all of his programmers are playing Tetris. And he asked, well, so what is this thing? And he said, well, it's, you know, it's this game that came from Moscow, it's Tetris. And he noticed that everybody was hooked to it. And so he decided this would be something. And so he, well, sort of living behind the Iron Curtain part way, living in Budapest, which was still back behind the Iron Curtain back then, he decided that he would be able to take that program and license it around the world. Well, he licensed it to one company called Mirrorsoft. Small detail about that is that he did it before he actually got the license himself. You know, he figured, those dumb Russians, they won't be able to figure it out. And they're not going to sue me. They're not going to come after me. And it's not going to be a big deal. I mean, I guess everybody who was there at that time, maybe except me, thought that Tetris wasn't a big deal and it wasn't going to last. And by the time anybody cared about it, it would be over. And so he licensed Tetris to Mirrorsoft, and Mirrorsoft licensed Tetris to Spectrum Holobyte, and Spectrum Holobyte licensed Tetris to me.
And when did you first see Tetris?
There's two competing stories. I got an email from somebody recently. One story is I was at, and I know this is true, I was at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas.
And this was 1988,
January. And I was at the Spectrum Holobyte booth, and there was Tetris. And so I played, and I went away and came back, and I played again. I went away and came back and played again. I was hooked. And, you know, I was at that point following my own gut feeling about what I liked and what I didn't like. I was looking for games to bring back to Japan. And Tetris turned out to be one of those games. I guess the other story is it was a Commodore 64 product, and a friend of mine was in the business. He was working for, I think, Activision at the time. He was bringing Activision games into Japan, and he got the game, but his Commodore 64 was broken for some reason. So he gave me a bunch of games that included Tetris, and said, you go look at it, you know. So I did.
Yesterday when we talked, you told me about how you discovered Tetris for the first time, and then you started to tell me what your ideas were for it, that you were going to license it, and I think, where were you going to bring it first? Was it just Japan, or did you already have images of taking it all over the world?
Well, no. Back then, I was a publisher in Japan. Because I, as I told you before, I started my own publishing company after creating a role-playing game. And I switched from making games myself to traveling around the world, licensing games from various countries to bring to Japan, because I thought that would be easier. And Tetris was one of those games. So my original intention was to publish Tetris on every hardware that I could get my hands on in Japan.
So you already had images of taking it to every hardware out there, but you were focusing on just Japan.
Right. That's where my reach was back then.
And what I read about Tetris was that there was, and you started talking about it yesterday, some fight over who owned it and where it was going to go. And it seemed like in the early days, everyone who was interested in Tetris was thinking just computers. But you already were thinking things beyond the computer, and maybe you didn't imagine handheld devices being what they are today. But you had an image of something beyond the desktop.
Sure. You know, at the time, Game Boy was a new device. And so getting on Game Boy and being like the most popular game on Game Boy back then, and a game that appealed to everybody, not just little boys, that was a huge, I would say, win for me back then. And we were looking at PDAs, you know, like Apple Newton. There were they're that kind of devices that were appearing in Japan. So I had those, you know, we did Tetris for those machines as well.
Okay, so how did you get the license from the Soviets, people who aren't used to doing these kind of deals, to bring it back to Japan?
I got on a plane, basically. It was kind of goofy. I had an agent. I had hired the guy who ran Andromeda in Budapest to be my agent. And he put me off and put me off. But it was like months. He said he was going to go to Moscow, and I had paid him a bunch of money, and he was supposed to go and represent me and get those rights. And it was taking so long that I thought something fishy was going on, and something fishy was going on, and that I didn't know about. The fishiness that was going on was that he hadn't actually gotten any of the rights which he said he had so far. And that's what he was trying to sort out with the Russians. And he was having a tough time because they didn't actually like him. They, you know, he went there and said, you know what? I'm doing this. I can pay you a little bit of, you know, share or not, come and sue me, you know, that kind of thing. So he already kind of figured out that they would never be able to reach outside the Soviet Union and come after him or something like that. They don't recognize their legal system. So he was trying to sort that out. And of course he didn't tell me that. I mean, he could, I don't know if he could or couldn't tell. He didn't tell me that. And so after months went by, I heard something that somebody else was dealing Tetris for Game Boy. And that kind of freaked me out. I thought, oh my God, he's double dealing. That's what's going on. He's negotiating with other people. That's what I thought. And I don't know whether he was or whether he wasn't. But anyway, I said, I'm going to Moscow and sort this thing out myself. And basically, I got a tourist visa. And 2 days later, I was on a plane to Moscow.
And you went straight to the school where this was created?
Well, no, because it's very difficult to find things at this point in time in Moscow. I got on a plane and landed there, and I didn't have any information about anybody. And I don't speak, read, or anything Russian. And so I needed a friend, and I thought I could find a friend at the Russian Go Association. There must be such a thing. There must be Go players. Go is a Japanese board game. I play it. And so I tracked them down, and it took me like, gosh, a day and a half to track them down. And I played Go with the third strongest Go player in the Soviet Union. That was pretty interesting. But Sucker didn't speak any English. So I had a friend, but he could be of no help. But I hired an interpreter. I figured that one out. I hired an interpreter. And she immediately found all the I mean, nobody at the hotel could help me. Nobody had any information. And what I was looking for, ELORG, or Elektronotechnika, which is the, at that time, the Ministry of Export of and Import of Software, something like software and hardware. And it's a funny thing, because she wouldn't go into the building with me because I was not invited. See, I was breaking all kinds of rules and walking through barriers and walls that people really perceive over there. But you don't just show up at a ministry and expect to talk to somebody. You have to be invited. And I don't know how you get invited, but you know what I'm saying. It's a sort of a cart before the horse kind of thing. So I walk in the door of this ministry, and I said, look, I want to talk to somebody about Tetris. And this guy comes walking down the stairs. And says, who are you? I said, my name is Hank Rogers. I'm the publisher of Tetris in Japan. And I showed him the box. And he said, for which machine is this? He asked me. And I said, it's for the Nintendo. It's a console. And he said, we never licensed Tetris for console to anybody. And I'm going, whoa, that's a huge deal for me right there. And I said, well, I'd like to talk to somebody about that, you know, the whole thing, because I'd like to do the proper business, and I'd like to meet with somebody tomorrow. And I said tomorrow because I figured they needed to get the right guys in the room, and they probably wouldn't be at the ministry when I showed up. And so I was given that meeting the next day, and that's the meeting at which I met Alexei. They called in Alexei. They, I don't know, probably a bunch of KGB guys in the room. and they grilled me. I mean, because I wasn't supposed to be there. In fact, he got in trouble.
Alexei did.
No. The old guy, Mr. Belikov. Actually, he wasn't old. He was my age. But, you know, Soviet life wears you down a little bit more than I guess, Asia life. I don't know. But so Mr. Belikov is the one who met me at the bottom of the stairs. And he took a lot of heat. I don't know, how dare you invite somebody without asking us first? That was the KGB. I found out later that they recorded his conversations. And they investigated him as a result of all of this. You know, your report is inconsistent. You, blah, 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 blah. So what the hell? It was just a little negotiation of a computer game, for Christ's sake. Get a life. So KGB was pretty hyper about all of this. And we got through. And that's kind of how I did that.
And so you were able to bring back the license to Japan.
At that time I was dealing, I was trying to get the deal for Tetris for Game Boy for the world.
I see. How much did it help you that you had Nintendo behind you?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, it was the reason I got on the plane. If I didn't have Nintendo behind me, you know, I'd be out there and I could say a bunch of things, but that, you know, they wouldn't have the weight that they did when I said, well, Nintendo's behind this. I'm not sure if I mentioned that I had Nintendo. I might have just said that I had a big company behind me or something like that. Could be.
How'd you get Nintendo to work with you?
That's another story. So I'm a publisher in Japan with a bunch of other companies. And, you know, this is a who's who of the big computer game companies today. Square, Enix, they were the top two companies. And we show up at Nintendo, five of us, five presidents of five companies show up at Nintendo. And basically we said to them, so we'd like to become Nintendo publishers. And at that time, Nintendo controlled who did what. You had to buy the cartridges from them. They set the terms and conditions between us and distribution. I mean, it's something that you can't do in this country. It was totally monopolistic, but they control the whole food chain of Nintendo games. And they said, number two came out, Mr. Imanishi said, you guys don't know anything about how to make console games. So the answer is no. It was like, that's so ridiculous. It was so ridiculous. I mean, it's like we collectively probably made them way more money than anybody else at the end of the day. And they were just blowing us off, you know? So we were kind of going back to our respective, you know, a bunch of us lived in Tokyo. So we were in the train kind of dejected, thinking, what the hell, blah, blah, blah. And my wife read a magazine article that Mr. Yamauchi plays Go. It's a Japanese board game. And I had that at that time gotten my hands on a Go game, a 9x9, which is like a baby Go. It's like chess on 5x5 or something like that for the Commodore 64. And that Commodore 64, anybody knows Commodore 64? That's an old machine from the old days. Well, the CPU in the Commodore 64 is a 6502, which is the same CPU as the Nintendo 8-bit. And so I knew that the algorithm would translate bit for bit from the Commodore to the Nintendo machine. We would just have to change the I/O, everything to do with button presses, everything to do with graphics or music. And so I had a little team of programmers that could do that. So I went to, I sent Mr. Yamauchi a fax. This is Tuesday. Sent him a fax. Mr. Yamauchi, my name is Hank Rogers. I can make a Go game for your Nintendo machine. I'm leaving for the U.S. on Saturday. I would like to see you and talk about it. Would you see me? And the next day I got a fax back. I mean, it's like, bam, you know. It takes people years to get to see Mr. Yamauchi, but the fact said, Mr. Yamauchi will see you tomorrow.
Just because of his passion for Go.
Well, I don't know what his curiosity about a crazy gaijin or what. I don't know. It might have been a combination of things. So anyway, this is my first meeting in Japanese. I decided not to bring an interpreter because interpreters have failed me up till then. So I want to make sure nothing got lost in the translation. Even though my Japanese is crap, I'm still going to do this in Japanese. And anyway, So there I am in the room with Mr. Yamauchi, and he looks at me and he says, well, I can't give you any programmers. And I said, well, I don't need any programmers. I have programmers. What I need is money. I need money. And so then he looks at me and says, well, how much money do you need? And I'm thinking of the biggest number I could possibly think of. And I said, $300,000. And he looked at me and he said, deal. And he reached across the table and shook my hand. I said, oh, my God, I should have asked for more money. That was way too easy. I found out later, Yamauchi makes all those decisions like that. They're bam, you know, decide. You know, he knows what's going on. So 9 months later, I go home. It's like, yeah. I contact the program. I don't know him at all. I contact him. He's in England. I said, you got to come to Japan. I got this deal for you. You know, we could put your game on the Nintendo machine. You can make some money. So I convinced him to come to Japan. And so I teamed him up with a couple of, you know, little hotshots that could do the graphics and all that. And we made a game. It was cute. We had flying ghost stones and little ninjas running around that, you know, your little helpers and so on. It was a cute game. And so 9 months later, having done the whole thing, I'm back in Mr. Yamauchi's office. And Mr. Yamauchi is now going to test this game. And he takes the controller, and it's obvious that he's never held a controller in his hand before, ever. You know what I'm saying? He doesn't know which button does what. He's trying to control it. And finally, he got a little frustrated, and he hands the controller to the guy next to him, one of his underlings. And he points at it. I say, I want to go there. I want to go there. I want to go there.
Wow.
That's how he plays the game, right? So he plays one game. He kicks the computer's ass. I mean, he's a 6-degree black belt in Go. This guy is like as good as amateurs get. And after beating the computer, he says, it's not strong enough for Nintendo. And I'm going, what does that mean? What does that mean? You know, does that mean you want your money back? Or what does it mean? And I'm thinking, I said, Mr. Yamauchi, you know, this is the strongest Go program that will ever appear on your machine. The machine is only 8-bit machine. It's not a very strong machine. And Go is a very complicated problem. It's the most complicated problem in artificial intelligence, blah, blah, blah. You know, I went through this little sales pitch, and he said again, it's not strong enough. Like, I didn't hear him the first time. It's not strong enough for Nintendo. And then I did some quick thinking. I says, well, you know what? It's strong enough for my company. At the time, my name, my company at the time is Bulletproof Software. And hold on, somebody's at the door.
Uh-huh.
What can it be? Taking a little
walk. Where are we today, by the way?
We're in my apartment in Honolulu.
Okay.
At the door. Oh, it's my assistant. In fact, I can walk out here and you can see.
Yeah, this is great. Through Skype, we're getting to see your life. Like.
Okay.
All right. So he was telling you that it's not strong enough.
It's not strong enough. So I did some quick thinking, and I said, well, you know what? It's strong enough for my company, Bulletproof Software. So why don't you let me publish it? And he looked at me and said, well, what about the money? I mean, can you imagine? I mean, $300,000 is such a small drop in his bucket. But he thought about that. And I said, I will pay you, and again, I did some fast negotiating. I will pay you a dollar. I mean, all these are dollar equivalent. I will pay you a dollar for every copy I sell until I've paid you back your $300,000. And he reached across the table and he said, deal.
Wow.
So I'm going, oh yeah, I just became a Nintendo publisher. And this is after he, you know, Nintendo blew all of us off. I have just found a way in through the door, because when Mr. Yamauchi says something, that's what happens. So just the rest of it's all formality. I get his underlings are in the room, and he's just told me that I could publish this game, which means I'm a Nintendo publisher, right? Cool.
And a great deal for you too, right? He's paying for your software, and you only have to pay him back if you make money on it, only a dollar per, or the equivalent of a dollar per. That's a great deal for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great deal. In fact, I only sold 150,000 units, so he never quite got his money back.
Yeah. So he paid for your software, and he made profit on it, but it started a relationship.
Yeah, That's right, Brett. That started that relationship. And, you know, I have, you know, great relationship with Nintendo all the way. And, you know, I was the only one in the entire industry that plays Go, for Christ's sakes. Can you imagine that? The game industry, nobody plays Go, which is the most amazing game ever, blah, blah, blah.
Not to the verb, but why don't they play Go if they're all in the gaming industry? Did it seem too basic and old-fashioned for them?
If you play, well, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. You know, it's kind of steeped in culture. And so when you play Go, they don't think of it as playing. It's much more serious than that. You know what I'm saying? Games, you play games and you have fun, and it's something that you do to waste time. But there's nothing wasting time about Go. It is a very serious thing. And so I would say a little too serious. And that's the problem with young people don't play Go. That's the reason. It's, you know, Go players come from an age when there were no video games. But if you have video games, why would you play Go? You know, Go actually, you have to study and you have to sit and you have to do all kinds of things and you have to behave. I mean, there are all kinds of things that kids are not very good at. So Go is just not, in my generation, is not very popular. I mean, the video game generation. So nobody plays Go. So I would set up my meetings with Mr. Yamauchi for a day when he is open in the afternoon. I would have my meeting and we would play Go afterwards. And then when we play Go, all of his underlings disappear. It's just the two of us in this big conference room with the Go board. And so we play Go, and he gets to find out what is really going on out there, because he can ask me, and I'll just tell him straight. I'm not like one of those. I'm not there to, how can I say, bow down to the emperor or that kind of thing. I just, you know, there's ways of talking in Japan. You talk up to a person, or you talk equal to a person, or talk down, depending on your status and your relative status. And I didn't know the difference about how to speak up or down. I could just barely speak. So my speak was a mishmash of up and down and across, but it was basically across. I never felt that I needed to, I don't know, talk up to him. And that was another thing that I think was very unnerving for everybody else around there, because I talked to him straight like he was my equal. And I got away with it. So by me getting away with it, that, I guess, meant something to everybody, including to him, I guess.
Okay, so you had this one game with him. You go into CES, you discover Tetris, and you decide you're going to take it back to Nintendo and say, I've got the next game that we'll work together on?
No, not exactly. I go to CES, and I find Tetris, and I'm the one who's going to publish Tetris everywhere. That's what I was. That's the mode I was in. I wasn't going to give something to Nintendo for them to publish. But the Game Boy thing, that was a different thing, because they were talking about huge numbers. More than I could possibly sell worldwide. If I could get them to publish Tetris with it, you know, for Game Boy. It's always the maker who can sell the most of any game on any platform. I mean, the maker of the hardware, because they have the distribution.
I see. I was trying to see then what the next... I was trying to find a question there to figure out what the next step was. So maybe I could just leave it like that. What was the next step then in the progress?
In the progress of my life, or...
Sorry, of how do you go from seeing it to ending up with that box that you took into the Soviet Union?
Oh, gosh, I mean, this is a long story. I mean, there's a lot of different hoops. This is the days of faxes. You know, I tracked down all of the people on the copyright notice, mm-hmm. on the box of, and I'm faxing them saying I'm interested in licensing, and I'm getting some replies, and finally 6 months into it, somebody comes to Japan and we talk the deal.
I see. You know what I keep seeing here in my notes? I keep taking notes as we talk here. It's just endless persistence. It's that you create a game, people aren't crazy for it, you go into the magazines and you show them the game one-on-one. You decide that you're going to make a game, you can't get in to see Nintendo, you find a way in through the back door. Through persistence, you decide that you're going to fax in, you're going to go in and talk to them one-on-one. Just over and over, this endless persistence, and it's really encouraging to see that. I don't see that in a lot of my interviews. I think people are a little afraid to show their determination or to show their ambition.
Yeah, behind every entrepreneur, there's somebody who has some crazy persistence. Because, you know, if I look back at my career and I look at all of the chances I had to bail and say, you know what, it's not working out, I think I'll go back and teach English. I mean, there's like those opportunities are everywhere. The society is telling you, you know what, you really shouldn't be doing this. You should have a job with an income, you know, blah, blah, blah. And somebody out there says, no, that's not the way it works for me. You know, I'm not having a job and buying life insurance and providing my family by dying someday. That's not how it's working. I'm going to, you know, do whatever it is that I do, and it's going to make me a pile of money. And then I'll go out and make another pile of money if I have to. But persistence, yeah, I guess, I don't know whether that is, I just hate losing, you know, I just can't stand losing. And the feeling of losing is a lot worse than failing, in my word. So I'd rather work, I'm not saying I never failed, but you know, when you fail, you say, oh, well, I learned that from that. And you go on, get up and do it again. You know, that's how it goes. But that's the way entrepreneurs are, I would say. You saying you interview other entrepreneurs are not like that?
They
gotta all be like that.
I think that they are like that, but they are afraid to talk about it. They're afraid to say that I wanted it. Instead, they say they give the PR story sometimes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. You know, there's something else that I was thinking. Earlier today, I talked to a young entrepreneur who suffered a setback in business, and he was saying that he's afraid to exude confidence now because he doesn't want to come off like a fraud, that in his head he's feeling like he hasn't achieved anything. And where does he suffered a big setback, where does he get off telling people that they should keep on working with him? Where does he get off motivating his people and telling people that his product is great? And that made me think of your experience with Black Onyx, where people weren't buying it, but you still were able to be confident about it and walk into those magazines and say, I've got this great game, you should see it, let me set you up. How, with such a big setback, do you overcome that feeling of failure enough to sell with confidence?
Well, I didn't think I'd failed. That's part of it. You know, well, maybe my advertising had failed, but I knew I had a great game. I'd seen people play it, and I'd seen people react to it. So I knew in my heart of hearts that I had created something that people wanted, and that it was just a matter of time.
But doesn't everyone think that what they created is great? You know, every little thing that we write, every little thing that I once had a drum, and I would just keep banging it, and I could tell that I'm banging out of tune. But I love the way that it sounded, and I couldn't stop myself from banging. I couldn't stop myself even though it was out of rhythm. Don't you look back and say, in those moments when things aren't going well, you say, maybe I'm just like everyone else who thinks that what they created is great. Maybe the world is telling me that I'm wrong.
Well, you have to find a way to do a sort of an independent test. You know, you can't just delude yourself into thinking that you're great. You've got to have a way of finding out that you are, in fact, are great. And it's not just people that are just trying to brown nose or whatever. That's a thing that gets hard. And that's what I was saying about Mr. Yamauchi, you know, at the emperor. I mean, he's up there on the top of his castle, and basically everybody tells him what he wants to hear. I mean, you would like get fired if you told him something he didn't want to hear. And I've met people like that too. So under those conditions, how the hell do you know whether your idea is working or not? I mean, everybody says, sure, it's working, boss, you know, whatever. Yeah, right, great, you know. but you got to be smart enough to be able to see the world through other people's eyes.
So how did you know that first game worked? What was your test with Black Onyx? You talked a little bit about it yesterday when you said that you played it for people, or you let people play it and you got feedback. Was that it?
It's hard for me to remember. I thought I'd created the greatest thing, and and I tested and I balanced it in the different people. I put it right in between the cloud of people that I had playing it to make sure that it wasn't too easy and too hard. And I plowed through the entire game, balancing it. That's probably the best balanced game I've ever created. Well, I haven't created that many games, but that, you know, it was a gargantuan effort squeezed into a very short time. And I was supremely confident. Nobody's going to tell me that, you know, my game wasn't as good or better than any of those other Japanese games. Are you kidding me?
All right, one more philosophical question, and then we'll get back into the story. If you could have a great game or great confidence, which do you think is better?
Wow. It's a great game, absolutely, because you could have all the confidence. And that's the problem. You get people with crappy games, and they have a lot of confidence, and they throw a gazillion dollars of advertising money behind a crap game. A game, if it's... it's what killed Atari. Atari bought the rights to do E.T. and they made a crap game. But because they were Atari, they owned it, blah, 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 they were going to sell 6 million units. You can't sell 6 million units of a crap game. It doesn't work. And so as a result, they flooded the market with all this inventory and a bunch of advertising, and the game flopped, sort of the market had to absorb 5 million copies of the stupid game that nobody wanted to play. And it tanked not only their own, not that game, but every other game, because every other game now had to compete with a game that was being dumped at, you know, a quarter of its retail price or whatever. It just tanked the entire market. And that whole Atari platform died as a result. And it's the reason that Nintendo always paid such close attention to how many units there are in the market. I mean, they control the market and make sure that that doesn't happen to their market.
Okay. Yesterday you told me that you talked about the longevity of Tetris. How does one game, very basic game, survive for as long as it has, especially with so many advanced games with advanced graphics coming out?
Yeah, so, how does golf survive? How does baseball survive? They're fairly rudimentary games. And if you look at them, they were obviously invented over 100 years ago by people who had nothing better to do, and yet they survive even in today's world. So what makes them survive? Is it new technology? Maybe some. New clubs make me want to play more golf. You know, I hit the ball farther and it's straighter and so on and so forth. So what we do for Tetris is we have what is called the guidelines. And what we do is we set the bar. And all of our licensees have to meet or beat the bar in order to get approved. And then each year we raise the bar a little bit. So we add new, by looking at all of the licensees and all of the things that we've thought about, that we've tested, we add little things that we think are improvements to Tetris. And it's equivalent to power windows and automatic transmission and, braking, that kind of stuff, ABS. These are things that show up not only in our game, but show up in other people's games. And we say, you know what, that's got to be included in every one of our games going forward. And so by raising the bar, we are not in danger of ever becoming a classic game. People sometimes say it's a classic game. What's the definition of a classic game? It's a game that people used to play in the old days but don't play anymore. Well, Tetris is not a classic game because Tetris is played more today than at any time in history. So you could say baseball is a classic game, but you don't think of it as a classic game. You think about it like it's a game that's being played right now, or golf, whatever. So by making sure that it never becomes a classic, we keep it in the middle of the market.
By just improving the game every year. So if you would have had Pac-Man, for example, how would you have kept Pac-Man current? That's a game that's considered a classic.
Oh, gosh. You're putting me on the spot here, but the behavior of the little Pac-Man, for example, it could become more interesting. You know, the behavior of those little Pac guy, the little ghosts and so on, they have no personality. They have, or I should say, their personality is frozen in time since 1982, whenever the game was invented. They could have gotten a little bit more interesting. They could have said something when they died, or they could become comical. They could have four different personalities. Now, you're having me thinking on the spot here, but I mean, that's the kind of thing that you got to think about. And if you leave it out there, sort of, if you have a dozen licensees and they're all trying different things, those kind of things come up naturally because, you know, game designers, that's what they do. And they, you know, we have licensees, they always come and say, can I try this? Can I try this? Sure, you can try that. Try it, and then we'll see. And if it's really good, then we'll make it. It becomes part of the standard.
I see. So you allow them to come up with their own ideas and experiment in their versions, and then whatever works, you bring back home to the mothership.
Yes.
Like, what ideas have come out of that? What's new?
Okay, well, out of that, for example, the hold piece. When you don't like the piece that's falling into the playfield just now, you have no place to put it, you can push a button and it'll hold it for you in a little box off the side of the screen. And then you, when you push that button again, it'll switch the falling piece with the one that's in the hold piece. And so if you get, for example, the long piece and you want to make a Tetris, but you're not set up, put it in the hold and then continue building. And when you've got your thing set up, then you call that long piece back. And so that was something that was invented by a licensee.
Okay. One more question about Tetris, and then I want to move on to life now and be fair with your time and not take up much more. 1996, I think, the license or the rights to the game reverted back to the Russian state. No, from the state no,
to
Alexei, right?
Yeah.
And then from what I see, that's when the Tetris Company LLC was formed. Are you an owner of that? And Tetris LLC owns Tetris?
Yeah. So what happened is at that time, we were, sort of the Elorg and I had our hands at each other's throats, saying Tetris is mine, I got it now, you know. They're saying that Alexei never had any rights because he's a Soviet citizen, blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying this is a human being and he has all the rights because he created the damn game. Give me, So I was ready to give them 20. They were ready to give me 20%. That was sort of where we were. But finally, we came through. We negotiated and it became a 50-50 deal. And so I created the Tetris Company. My company, which is based in Hawaii, called Blue Planet Software, is a 50% owner. And the other owner at that time was Elorg, Electronic Technica, which was the survivor of the ministry. In other words, the ministry goes private. How the hell does that happen? I don't know. But that's what happened. A bunch of guys said, no, we own it. It's no longer a ministry. Okay, right. So that worked for, a couple of years, for 7 years, something like that. And then it fell apart and they got greedy and we're back in court or preparing to go to court again about who really has the rights. And I then found a bunch of people that lent me the money to buy them out. And I bought them out. So I formed a new company called Tetris Holding, put the money in that company. And I used, and Alexei put his rights that he has in that company. So Tetris Holding is the place where all of the rights to Tetris live. And that Tetris Holding bought Elorg.
I see.
So we bought Elorg. And so within that company now, we have all the rights to Tetris. Elorg never had any rights, but they had the registration in like 60 different countries. Which would have taken us forever to litigate our way through. And, you know, a much, much cheaper way was just to buy them out.
Okay, so the owners now are, is it you and Alexei owns a few shares, and then your investors own also?
No.
They lent you the money.
Back. They lent me the money. I paid them back handsomely.
So what's life like for you now? We saw a little bit of your place, your two places in Hawaii. But...
So I right now I spend 4 days in Honolulu and 3 days on the Big Island. My 4 days in Honolulu, 3 days I'm in the office. So I've limited myself to 3 days in the office. I have four companies that are that I'm intimately involved with. Blue Planet, which is the company that takes care of Tetris. Tetris Online, which is a company that does casual games in the online space. Right now, we're only doing Tetris because that's where the money is. Mr. Arakawa, who used to run Nintendo USA, runs that company. He came out of retirement. He was retired on Maui playing golf, and I convinced him to come out of retirement. He loves being in the driver's seat. So he runs that company. And then number three is Blue Lava Technologies, and we make a little application. It was personally something I needed myself, something that I can use to tag my photos, because I got a gazillion pictures and I need a way to get them back in my life. What it does is it makes the tagging bit into a little game, and it's still tagging, even without facial recognition, is still better than the, we have facial detection, but without facial recognition, it's still faster than the iPhoto with facial recognition. Because ultimately, you know, the iPhoto is not sure whether that person is that person. You have to click on that person. In that instant where you're looking at it, you've just recognized that person.
Uh-huh.
So we are like the masters at facial recognitions. I mean, humans are. And we do it so much better than computers do. It's just ridiculous. So why take that pleasure center away? So anyway, that and it makes slideshows and sends them, or I shouldn't say slideshow. The word is photo feed, it's a photo feed. It's like what we do with Twitter, except we're doing with pictures. So you end up getting not only your pictures, but other people's pictures that are relevant to you into a photo feed. And you can have one of those digital picture frames, or you can have your mobile phone, or you can have your TV set. Turn on any channel that you want, you know, your kid's channel or whatever it is. Then the last one is the fourth company is called Avatar Reality. And Avatar Reality is, it's a virtual world. It's something like Second Life, but done right. And that group is mostly the leftovers of Square. That Square was in Hawaii, and they made a movie and a couple of games here.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had the great technology, the breakthrough technology to make that movie. Well, we're using that breakthrough technology real time now because computers can do this. And so we're at an order of magnitude more polygons and people and everything. And then we sort of protect people's IP. That's the other big difference. So when people create an object in our world and sell it to somebody else, they're the only ones who can do that, or they're the ones who have that copyright. And so that means brands can come into our world and not worry about everybody ripping them off.
And what do you do with the other 4 days of the week?
So then Saturday I play golf.
Uh-huh.
With my buddies at Wailai Country Club. And then, at the ranch, I have horses. When I was 7 years old, somebody asked me, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I said, cowboy. So now I'm learning how to ride horses because it's one of the things that I said I was going to do when I was a kid. I I'm almost completed my workshop there. And it's a workshop, sort of like a Mythbusters kind of workshop. And so we're going to be building things there. What we're not about busting myths, but what we want to do is validate people who have some technology that can help us store solar or wind energy. See, Hawaii has a lot of intermittent renewable energy, but the problem is storage. So that is the thing that we have to... I just want to try them all and see what the deal is, apples to apples. Figure out how much energy it takes to store energy in this format, how much you know, what percentage you get back at the end of the day.
I see.
And keep track. And our first project, for example, is comparing solar panels. So we have a bank of all these different companies' solar panels, and we put them side by side.
Uh-huh.
Under the exact same conditions. and we test them on a second-by-second basis to see what's going out, going on. And then we monitor things like clouds going over and seeing what effect it has on... Can you believe that nobody's done this?
No.
This data doesn't even exist. I can't believe it. I mean, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. And the simplest thing of putting them side by side and seeing which what's what, nobody's done that.
Where are you going to report this stuff? Are you going to share the information?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, it's not, the information is not for me. It's to make those guys better. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
If somebody comes out and says, okay, well, this guy is giving you 22% and this one's giving you 25%, it's like miles per gallon. When you report that stuff, all of a sudden the engineers and each of these companies, oh crap, we have to do better on that test. And so they start improving their technology.
Kind of like JD Power or Consumer Reports.
Yeah, something like that. So the other thing that I haven't told you about is I have a foundation to end the use of carbon-based fuel. It's called the Blue Planet Foundation. And our first stop is Hawaii. It's to end the use of carbon-based fuel in Hawaii. So we've got to get people out of gas-powered cars and into electric cars. We import $6 billion of oil every year. And this is like 1.2 million people. That's crazy. That's insane. How about, like, instead of sending 6 billion out, let's send 5 billion out there and keep a billion here and use it to build infrastructure for, you know, smart grid or whatever. It's that kind of stuff that it just seems so obvious and so simple, and yet it's like pulling teeth getting it done. And so we work with the politicians, with the legislature, with the Public Utilities Commission, with the Hawaiian Electric Companies, and all these different, and we educate people. So hopefully we can get this island or these islands off the grid.
And on to what? What would you replace them with?
Renewable indigenous forms of energy.
Like what?
We have all the geothermal you could possibly need. There's enough of it on the Big Island to feed all of Hawaii. Native resistance to tapping into Pele is what prevents us from building a cable and connecting that to Oahu. That's kind of crazy, right? It is kind of crazy. Then there's ocean thermal energy conversion. That is, you drop a pipe down to the cold part of the ocean, and you use the difference in the warm part and the cold part like a reverse refrigerator. So you pump a liquid through the warm, and it becomes a gas, and it runs a turbine, and then you pump it back down to the cold, and it becomes a liquid. So you have a little cycle. It's called a Rankine cycle.
And that's the kind of thing you want to test. You are going to see how much electricity comes from that kind of process.
Well, that has been tested, and that's a multi-million-dollar process. So that's just politics at that point. But then for the ones I've just mentioned are baseload, which means that they produce energy 24/7. In other words, they don't go on and off. The solar energy goes on and off because the sun's there and then it's not. And wind energy goes on and off because the wind's there and then it's not. So for those kinds of energies, you have to store it so that it can be, you know, you can tap the storage when the wind dies down or when it's nighttime. And so that's the other side of the equation that needs to be explored a little bit more.
And again, relentless persistence. Now you're going up against politics, against indigenous beliefs. You're going up against a lot here.
Yeah.
What's your?
And I'm not going to stop until I'm done. You know, this is.
What's your advice to entrepreneurs, people who are looking at you, who are looking at your accomplishments, who are saying, "I'm just as hungry."
Never give up.
Yeah.
that's one way of doing it. You know, it's like, what good is life if you can't do the things you really want to do? And the worst thing, here's the worst thing, is you thought of something and you started working on it and somehow the idea leaks out and somebody else does it. Oh, when that happens to you, you'll be burned. And so to prevent that from happening, you got to get to market with your product quicker than somebody else who happens to find it, you know. So there's a lot of people out there, there's a lot of jackals that will come and have your lunch for you. And, you know, there's So if you look at the way Apple innovates, they keep everything a secret. You talk to them, you can't wear your company shirt when you go to visit them because they don't want to know that you're in conversation with them, because somebody else up north is going to take that idea and act on it. So their only advantage is that they're a couple of years ahead, because they know that everything else is going to get copied.
I see. All right. Well, thank you for spending all this time with me. We've now spent at least 2 hours on the phone. I'm really grateful to you. I'm grateful to everyone who's been watching us live here. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. It's great meeting you, and I hope to meet you in person sometime.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye now. Aloha.
Aloha. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
And there it is. What a great interview. What a great guy for me to get to know. At some point, I would love to fly to Hawaii and get to know him in person. In fact, I would love to fly around the country and maybe even around the world and talk to every entrepreneur that I've ever done an interview with in person. I wish I had that kind of time. I'd love to do it. Maybe this is the kind of thing that somebody who's leaving college will be inspired to go do. Go travel the world and talk to every entrepreneur that I've ever interviewed here on Mixergy and just get to know them in person. I think that you can learn a lot from getting to know them in person. Sounds like a really fun trip too. If I was just leaving college right now, I would be doing that. All right, so as always, give me your feedback. What'd you think? How do we piece this thing together? This was a monster to piece together. Lots of individual pieces. What'd you think of the way that it sounded? What'd you think of the way it looked if you saw it on video? Give me feedback also on the ideas. Did I get to the point? Did I get to the ideas that you can actually use? Did I get to the ideas that will resonate with you, that will come back to you? I said in the beginning of the interview that the thing that I really admire about Hank is that attitude of, we have to find a way to make it work somehow. I keep looking back at my notes where I wrote that quote down during the interview. Is that something that will really resonate with you? Can you picture yourself in a moment where things aren't working out saying to yourself, no way, I have to find a way to make this work somehow. I remember Hank going into the Soviet Union. I remember him doing all this other stuff. I can make it work also. All right, second thing is, I'll link you over to Hank. I'd like for you to at least get, if you're not going to fly around the world and get to know the entrepreneurs that I'm interviewing here, I'd like you to at least get to know their websites. And I'll link you over to his site. Finally, what else is there? Lots of other interviews on Mixergy.com with entrepreneurs like Hank who take time out of their day to teach you so that you can go out there and leave your mark on the world. All right, so there it is. Thank you for watching. I'm Andrew, and I'll see you in the comments.